Here we go. May God have mercy on our souls.
It's Song Talk Radio with Michael, Neil, Phil, and the gang.
Hello. 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 Thank you for joining us here today on Song Talk Radio, the podcast that likes to talk about songs. So the title is very fortunate, I think, actually. We talk to each other about songwriting and share tips and tricks that we figured out along the way. You send in your tips and tricks and insights about songwriting that you figured out along the way, with the goal of this whole thing being that hopefully after the show we will learn at least maybe three new things about how to be a better songwriter. Yeah, three, four, five. I'll be your host. My name is Phil Emery, and along for the ride are the other dedicated members of the Song Talk Radio team. Mr. Neil Modi, how you doing, Neil?
Doing pretty good. You know, I've always been surprised that when we started this thing, no one came up with Song Talk before for a show or for a thing. Like, it wasn't a thing. Like, we grabbed that name and that was it. Like, yeah, there was no other podcast with that name. There was no other website with that name.
That is true. Filling in today for the Michael Proudfoot, who I guess was not as dedicated because he's off in the world in a quest to play all the golf, is friend of the show, Matthew Reed, a composer for film, television, games, and theater, and has a very big music brain. Thanks for being here, Matthew. How are you doing, Matthew?
I'm doing good. It's good to be back. It's good to be Mike. And not golfing on this thunderstorm day.
Yeah, poor Mike. Right. Hope he doesn't get rained out too much this week.
Well, there's lightning too. So that's good for the golf. Take
the big piece of sheet metal and then head to the tallest tree and for shelter, and you're good.
Indeed. While we are all out here song talking, listeners can send us your questions, comments, or the insights on anything we talk about to feedback@songtalk.ca, and we will do our best to respond to them. And if you happen to be watching us here on YouTube, please click on like and or subscribe buttons. If you click on subscribe, you'll get a little notification when the next show is out. And that actually helps this show quite a bit by getting YouTube to recommend it to other folks who like things talking and all things song. So that would be great. So I think the only news I have to share is on a whim, I bought a new chorus pedal from Amazon, and the quality is amazing. For $49.99, you get a steel, like a really sturdy steel chorus pedal that sounded fantastic, by this company called Donner. They're actually the same people who made my drum set, turns out, and they're doing some great stuff. So this isn't a paid promotion. This is just my experience, but some surprisingly good stuff, you know.
It certainly seems to be a thing now with the pandemic on and everything that you can buy a musical instrument without going to the music store and actually trying it out, or a pedal or whatever, just buy it online. And it used to be always, you'd always want to go to the store and try something out before you bought it, right? Mm-hmm. This past year, I bought a ukulele, I bought a new controller keyboard without having ever tried either of them, and perfectly happy with them. But
you're good. Yeah.
It wasn't a thing before. It certainly wasn't
something
you'd think of before.
But
not really. I can't imagine buying a saxophone or any other sort of old school acoustic instrument that way.
Mm-hmm.
I bought electric guitar online, and actually it's been one of my favorite ones.
So
interesting stuff. So if you want to out there share your latest purchases, because half the fun of all this music stuff is buying new toys, and why don't you share them with us? We'd love to hear what new toys you've gotten out there. Right. Let's coming up to our guest. Anna Larson is an emerging singer-songwriter who fuses diverse musical roots with piano-driven originality. Her song Acting Alone has appeared on NPR Music's All Songs Considered, as well as placing in the 2019 Woody Guthrie Songwriting Competition. And she joins us today all the way from Austin, Texas. And let's take a bit of a listen to her song.
Thank you. the place that we all live in. And on a day we're so ordinary, and a line was drawn out, it's before and after.
And there's a little... Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Yeah,
happy to be here.
Hello. So, hello.
Hello.
Right. So now, are you from Austin, Texas? Is quite the musical center for songwriters.
We are known for it. Yeah.
Almost a second Tennessee, Nashville, in some ways.
It is. I mean, I'm not really sure if you know what the difference in flavor is, maybe between, because it's definitely, you know, pretty country, you know, in that style of singer-songwriter. But to me, Nashville seems more commercial, you know, in I don't know, the tone of the musical scene than Austin does. But certainly, yeah, there's, I mean, you know, you're the person checking you out at the grocery store or working on your car or maybe fixing your computer or any number, selling you a house, any number of things. It's probably also a fantastic songwriter, you know. That's kind of how it goes down here. So, yeah.
Are you from Austin natively or?
I am a native Texan, but I grew up in the Dallas area. So I didn't go very far.
But I wanted to ask you, so did you, like, you moved to Austin for
school,
music?
For school. So it's a big university town also. The University of Texas, which is like a gajillion people, is also here. And so I came here to go to music school at the university. And I'm one of the many, many people who liked it a lot here and didn't really see any reason to leave. So I didn't. I've been here for a long time, yeah.
So what did you study when you went to music school? This is post-secondary, obviously, right?
Like, both. My undergraduate and graduate degree also. Right. I studied piano okay. performance was my...
Okay. And it was a dedicated music program like so many are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not a conservatory level kind of situation, but
right.
But I mean, I guess pretty close. I mean, it was cutthroat. I like to tell people that music school was kind of like the Marines. I felt like they were sort of breaking you down to build you back up. Classical pianists are pretty. They're intense.
They are indeed.
They're serious. They're a serious lot.
I had a similar schooling here in Toronto, and we had a lot more professors from Europe and the UK. I don't know if that was your situation too in Austin, old school German and Austrians, and some very British professors who did not suffer fools easily.
No, I had a accompanying professor that, when I came to, my eyes were opened to how much better I needed to be when I showed up here, you know, with my eyes big and shiny. And I needed to be put through my paces for sure. But I had an accompanying professor who would I think it was like my first semester of school, and she would stand behind you, you know, in performance class or whatever. And if things were not going the way that she thought they should go, she would just growl. This very sort of low, and I'm not sure anybody else in the class could hear it. Maybe they could, but I could hear her when the growl. And I think the closest thing I ever got closest thing to a compliment that I ever got from her at the, I don't know how many semesters, it felt like eternity, like the number of semesters I had to work with her. And the last thing she ever said to me was like, I was a meeting and she goes, well, I think you will be okay. Like, you know, your life is not going to be an utter disaster. You may be able to eke out some sort of musical existence.
And if that was a scene in a movie, that would be your nowhere else but up. You're superstardom. Yes. Talking yes. like act in act.
Yes.
When does that happen? Act four or act five?
I don't know.
The disaster's act four, right?
Yeah. So I'm still waiting for my next one.
Can you talk, Anna, yeah. about how that education and how that paradigm of stuff kind of led you into singer-songwriter?
Well, you know, I'm not like a lot of singer-songwriters who I think, you know, were, you know, 12 years old in their bedroom with a guitar. I mean, I was definitely writing bad poetry. That's for sure. But I wasn't one of those like teenagers that was writing songs with my instrument from the get-go. For me, like writing and music were always sort of on separate paths, separate tracks. You know, for whatever reason. But the thing that studying music in that really intense, serious way, I mean, it gave me a lot of discipline, that's for sure. And even though classical music sort of, I don't know, it like fits me like a shirt that you want it to look good on you, but it doesn't really, you know, like the sleeve is a little too short and you really want it mm-hmm. to look cool, but it's just like it sits in the back. That's kind of how classical music and I are. But at the same time, that that experience gave me the ability to know that I didn't have to just take a job. I could actually like be a musician. And I mean, I teach piano, and that's one thing I've gotten out of music school. That has served me, you know, this whole time. But I, you know, a lot of that stuff that you learn that's sort of stuffed in your brain, you have to let it filter out. And you're left with the good things that are gonna serve you. And so I think, I think the discipline part of it, and understanding how music works and how it's constructed and all of that, you know, chord structures, and not that I set out to, you know, analyze all the chords when I'm writing a song or something like that. But I feel like it's in there. And if you want to make a choice in one way or another in the process of writing a song, just knowing what all the options are, you know?
And did you find learning classical theory that way was exciting and eye-opening, learning sort of like the nuts and bolts or what's inside the machine
and what
you could do with it?
I like it. The thing that always kind of nagged at me, though, and as a piano player, like you're when you start learning piano from an early age, you usually have a whole bunch of theory along the way. That's just that's just how it goes. Yeah. But the thing that always kind of nagged at me at the higher levels is, you know, you're dissecting these really big pieces of music. And I was like, man, you know, was Beethoven really thinking about this? was he like, okay, is this the five of five? I don't know. You know, that sort of always bugged me about how we kind of, it's not reverse engineering, but it is, you know, it's that sort of thing. We're coming to it after the fact. But it's useful to be able to like look at a Beatles song and go, wow, why does that sound cool to me? Mm-hmm. What is going on at this spot? Mm-hmm. And you know, when you're learning cover songs and things like that, sometimes you come away going, wow, I thought this was way more complicated than it actually is. And so how you think about the songwriter maybe, you know, is different. Or you might come away with, realizing that something is a different design and a lot more intricate or something more interesting than you thought. So being able to take things apart, you know, is definitely a tool that all that study gave to me.
And certainly, like, compared to singer-songwriters, like you say, who grew up, you know, in their bedrooms strumming on a guitar.
And not to say that's not a great path. Certainly not.
But the tendency, and I'm trying not to generalize here, but, you know, the tendency tends to be, you know, 1-6-4-5.
Yeah.
And a lovely melody and a lovely lyric. And when I listen to your stuff, I get the impression the lyrics are really, really important to you. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, your depth of musical knowledge comes through too, and that you're playing with different colors of of musical chords and mm-hmm. and different yeah. things. And I'm always looking to, as a listener, I'm always looking to mm-hmm. hear something that's melodically interesting, lyrically interesting, and musically interesting, and the harmonic structure is something that I've maybe haven't heard before, or that's a little bit surprising. So I'm glad to hear that. That you seem like you've struck a good balance between those two things.
Yeah, and I think all that stuff is in there. I don't think when you're writing a song, I mean, I don't think any of that is like top of mind mm-hmm. because then you would get in your own way. I think a lot of those choices maybe come to you in like when you're revising a song or when you're look, you know what I mean? When you're trying to, it's not in that lightning bolt kind of mm-hmm. moment that you're mm-hmm. that you're thinking about things like that. But yeah, lyrics are really important to me, and melody. I think that's where my ear goes automatically. I think that, for whatever reason, a catchy melody, or even, I mean, singing harmony. There were a lot of things that were, like I was saying, or were like on different paths, and things didn't really come together for me in terms of, you know, writing my own music, writing, singer-songwriter stuff until maybe about, 10 years ago or so, maybe even a little bit less than that. So I've been playing music, you know, since the beginning of my life, essentially, but I didn't really start writing music the last eight to 10 years, something like that. Wow. So I still feel like a little bit of a newcomer, in terms of hanging the singer-songwriter shingle out there.
What was the breakthrough moment? What was that? I should do this today.
I feel like it was like a two-step thing. So I had always been involved, or not always, but I would always. Since maybe my early 20s, I'd had a large group of friends who were in theater, because mm-hmm. I always thought the theater folks were way cooler than the music school people.
Terrible influence, the theater people. Yeah. They're the worst. they will get you in trouble every time. But anyway.
Every time. That's why I wanted to hang out with them. So, but they're, some of my dearest friends. And eventually, over time, they would rope me in like, hey, we've got to have somebody to run the light board. You have two hands.
And, that's where and it starts. They get you with the board. Right.
So they led me down the garden path like that. And eventually we started doing a lot of collaborative script writing. And that moment of, I'd always written. I wrote a lot of poetry. I wrote, I just had always been, seen myself as a writer, but I didn't put it together with the music side of things. Mm. So when we started writing scripts and all of that kind of stuff, it opened up a lot of creativity for me, creative energy that hadn't been used in a while. And I decided, I'm going to write the script. So I'm also going to write incidental music to go with this play. And we're going to perform it live, and we're going to have it, scene change music, and I'm going to write a theme to go with each of the characters, and we're going to like weave that in. I don't know.
That confidence was there.
Yeah. And it was, I just did that. And I was like, man, I need to do more of this. and step two was my neighbor who lives, we're talking about Austin being a great place where you throw a rock and like you hit 25 songwriters as it comes down.
Right.
But my neighbor who lives about three doors down from me, he was over one time and he was like, yeah, we're starting a band. It's going to be sort of an indie folk vocal harmony Fleet Fox kind of, sort of thing. And I was like, hey, do you need a keyboard player? And he was like, yeah, I guess so. Can you sing harmony? I sang harmony in church growing up, but I'd mm-hmm. never like sung harmony on a stage with people in a band. But I was like, yeah, mm-hmm, sure can. Cool. And, that's really what kicked it out, the singing and the writing, yeah. And it all just kind of from there. So, yeah.
I was laughing at the, I guess so. That seems to be always the reaction when you ask, do you need a keyboard? I guess so.
We'll put you in the back and we'll turn you way down.
Don't move. Yeah, don't move too much.
Yeah, you're there for color. You're there for color.
I've always wondered about people who move to another city to pursue music? If that, do you think that makes you more focused in a way that you wouldn't be if you were just, you know, still in Dallas?
I just had to get away from Dallas, Texas. It's not a, I hope everyone in Dallas that's listening to this are like, oh, turn it off. She's going to, you know, badmouth Dallas, Texas. It didn't feel like the right creative spot for me. So, I don't know. I don't think, you know, I came here for school, and I, at that age, you know, I was like 18, 19, I knew that I was going to go to music school, and I knew that I had to do something creative so that I would never have to have a normal job. That was my thought. I'm like, I'm going to go, you know, I'm not going to go to business school. I'm not going to go be a lawyer or an accountant or something like that. I knew that I had to go someplace where I could figure out how to, you know, find a creative path in my life. So I don't know. The thing that made me really focused, honestly, was the fact that I had a music scholarship. And if I didn't have the scholarship, I would have to go back and, like, I don't know, work in a grocery store, you know, or I don't know what I would have done. But that kept me focused.
It would make a big difference.
As it would.
Yeah. So that's where my focus was.
Can you talk a little bit about acting alone? Like, where was the start of the song? Where did it come from?
Well, I was really fortunate to have been in a songwriting group for quite a while, and it was a group where we would you know, you send out a prompt, like a, you know, short something or other, and have a week to write and incorporate that lyric, or, you know, you could break it up or incorporate it up in somewhere. And the moment in time where this song was written was, you know, in the United States, we have a really, really big epidemic with gun violence. It's a big problem that no one seems willing to actually do much of anything about. And when I wrote that song, I wrote it sort of in the middle of the week, and it was bookended by two horrific shootings, one of which was really close to Austin. It was in a town a little bit south from here. And it's unbearable, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's where the song came from. And I was in the habit of writing all the time because of the songwriting group. And I think when you're in that habit, you can just sit down and sort of, like, put the antenna up and put yourself in the right spot to catch whatever's out there. But this is one of those songs that was like a really, you know, came out in one whole piece sort of thing.
It wasn't like lyrics first and then music, or it was kind of all together?
I usually write lyrics and I usually write things a lot of the times all together. I may go back, and a lot of times what I'll do is write out the lyrics after I've found some, and you know, when I can visualize it, then I kind of have a better sense of, I'm going to rearrange this and take that and take this verse and make it the first verse and things like that. But this is one of those songs I wrote it for me, mentioning all of my piano, I wrote it on guitar, and I'm not really a guitar player, but the reason why I like to write on guitar is because I can't get in my own way. Because I don't really know enough on the guitar to make it too complicated.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know what I mean? It's a good tool. It's a good tool that way. And I should mention, on that recording that we listened to, that is my dear friend and collaborator, John Michael Rogers, playing the guitar on that track. But I wrote this song on guitar because I wanted it to be so focused on the story and the lyrics, and I wanted that to come through and not be obscured by, you know, instrumental busyness or anything like that. Mm. And to me, the what I'm trying to get across in that song and the lyrics is you know, what we do in the States is we tend to, well, it's not my fault. It's somebody else's problem. It's not me. It's not my family. So it's not, you know, it's somebody else, you know, that guy. And the phrase acting alone, I think that was actually, that may have been our prompt. And I very rarely will take a prompt and use it as like the, you know, centerpiece of a song. Mm. But, you know, I was trying to say that, you know, we like to say, well, it was a person that was acting alone. So it was this isolate. He was just acting alone. So then it's not my fault. But I think that we're all culpable because there's everything is so interconnected. There's no way that one thing can just be, you know, there's something that led to that. So, yeah, acting alone is not really acting alone.
Do you consider this a protest song?
Yeah, I do. I do. Oh. And there are lots of political songwriters out there. There are a lot of people that are not afraid to, you know, just really hit,
say it.
Yeah, to say it. And I don't consider myself to be one of those people. I like artful language and don't necessarily, you know, write things that are very on the nose and things like that. I like imagery. I like storytelling and all that kind of stuff. And even though I do think that this is a sort of, there is a story in this song, for me, this is, it's definitely a protest song. Yeah, for sure.
One thing that I think we should listen for, which I think is really cool, is that the melody doesn't go where you think it's going to. Mm. Like it doesn't sort of resolve in a really sort of obvious way.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at the end of the lines, which I thought was really kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something to listen for. So why don't we take a listen to it now?
Huh?
Let's do it.
Oh, what a shame that there's no way
was acting alone.
Yeah, what a great yeah. tune.
Lovely.
Thanks. You know, we were talking about chord structures and things like that. And I have to admit, I was saying how I wrote this on guitar. And the going back and forth between like playing it, because I always use a capo to play it, and then thinking about the actual chord changes, things like that, always messes with my brain, like the transposition and things like that. So I will admit my theory weakness sometimes when it comes to
capo on a piano.
Yeah, thinking through all those chord changes and things like that. Yeah, but I think that the chorus, and the chord that kind of changes in there, there's an F. It's either like an F, it's at the beginning of the chorus, it's an F minor chord, I think. And then right before that, sort of at the end of the verse, right before you go into the chorus, it's an F major. And so I tend to do that. And I don't know if I do that on guitar just because, you know, modulating between major and minor on an individual chord, like just expands my palette just a little bit, you know, if I'm not able to do like a full on key change. But I think some of those limitations, like from my own limitations, come out with some with chord progressions on a guitar song that I wouldn't necessarily do on a piano, you know, because maybe I would go to the more expected chord change. But I tend to like to do that, is to change the chord quality, you know, from what it's expected to be in the key that I'm in. Just, you know what I mean? As a way to, I don't know, change the color or heighten that moment or that sort of thing.
I think that's actually really interesting, because like I'm a piano player. Yeah. Phil's a guitar player.
Yeah.
And that is mostly piano, aren't you, Matt? Yeah. And to me, like going from an F major to an F minor on the piano was really easy, and I don't know if it's obvious, but it's really easy, because it's really just one note difference, one finger, right? Whereas on a guitar, if you're going from F major to F minor, you're like you're going from an open position to a barred position. It's like it's far away. Whereas on a piano, it's really, really close.
It's really close. But the thing is, if you've got the cheater weapon of the capo, and you got that's my workaround. Right. Everyone's gonna go, guitar player. Oh my god.
Gotcha. But it is here. It's I find it a little odd hearing guitar pieces in C minor. It's not as idiomatic, and it's not a bad thing. It's you know, you usually hear these sad songs so often they're in D minor, or maybe they'll be tuned down to C sharp minor or A minors, and C always feels very idiomatically piano, doesn't it, in a sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe I just can't escape the piano no matter what I'm doing.
your ear just tends to go there.
Yeah, and honestly, I had never even played the song on a keyboard instrument, I think, until the only like live in person really thing that I got to do in 2020 at the very beginning was go to Folk Alliance. And I decided in my infinite wisdom that since everybody there would be playing guitars, that I would bring my keyboard and schlep it from room to room to play the little mini showcase things. And so I, you know, had to transpose songs that I normally play on guitar, you know, like over to piano. And that was kind of interesting and also kind of terrifying, because, you know, you get in the habit of playing certain things a certain way, and then, you know, you decide to flip everything on its head.
Well, it's hard not to reinterpret it if you're going to do it, you know.
Yeah, and that song, I think, definitely, like, I slowed it down and you know, discovered different, you know, leading tones and lines and things like that that I hadn't thought of before. But, I do that sometimes. I'll write a song on one instrument and then try it out on the other one. And I can't do that with every single song. But going back and forth is interesting to me, but it's also confusing. And then I'm like, why am I doing this to myself? Why, you know? Because you know, I'll be playing a gig and I'll be like, "What? Hold on, which way am I going to play it just now?" Okay, you know.
One thing I loved about the song is, mm-hmm. on the last line of the verse, mm-hmm. when you go like the read on the radio, mm-hmm. on the radio, those are really unexpected chords there, mm-hmm. like because it does have a certain like it looks like he was going to kind of felt like he was going to resolve, but it mm-hmm. didn't, and I thought that was so interesting. Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem like it was, because sometimes I think when songwriters do something unexpected, it just sounds like, can sound like a mistake.
Mm.
Or it can sound like something that, you know, look didn't really work weird. Out.
All right.
Or like,
so we go to the G major there, right?
Yeah, the very last part of that the radio, the first, it's like, because radio is twice, right? Yeah. So the first time, I believe it lands on that F major chord that I was talking about. And the second time, radio, then it goes to the G. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which I thought was so
four
neat.
Four to the five.
Yeah, but, it comes down E flat to B flat to G major. Mm-hmm. So you have that mode mix too. So you have that
mm-hmm.
That lovely B flat to B natural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then instead leading to when you're leading, you think you're going to go back to C minor, but of course the C you hear then is then to the F minor.
It's exactly. So I guess there's a lot of like all that modulation, the mode changes of the major and minor. It just bring like all that half. I guess it just increases. I guess like the half step movement, mm-hmm. what you're hearing, which you know half steps are.
It's a very piano thing.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, I don't know. Would you say that half steps are unstable? I guess they are, but I mean, well,
they
those leading tones
can be.
That are involved.
That's what they want to do.
That's what they want to do. It just depends on what
they're,
which
I mean,
half
they're unexpected because most pop music doesn't really use them. And
except for leading tones.
I mean, and I went through a whole period where I was, every time I would do a chorus, I wouldn't do a fifth. I would do like, I would drop it a half step or raise it a half step, you know, just because it sort of throws the whole melody into a different kind of feel. You have to do a bit of like finagling to get back into the original key again, because, you know, they're not naturally up against each other, but it's a fun thing to do, actually.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, speaking of key changes like that, like those sort of like modulation at the, maybe it's like the final chorus of, I'm thinking of like Adele does things like this, right? Mm-hmm. She's going to take it to a different key so that it, you know, goes into the stratosphere or someplace that I can't sing for sure. And sometimes key changes like that's a really good example of things that sound forced a lot of times to me, if they're not done well.
Especially that rising up by a semitone toward for the last chorus.
Yeah.
That old chestnut.
Yeah. I honestly don't tend to do things like that consciously because I don't know, like vocal range. I don't want to get into like the danger zone for me anyways. But I do like to play with that modulation of chord quality, expected chord quality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all have that idea of like, okay, well, you know, two is going to be like this and the four is going to, and the six has got to be minor and things like that. But I kind of just like one of my favorite things to do is go, no, I'm not going to make it a minor six. I'm going to make it a major six or, you know, that sort of thing. I like to do. And one of my guitar players that plays in my band a lot, he's like, oh God, it's another weird Anna chord. Why are we, you know, it's like, I can't guess where we're going to go next.
Philistines.
Yeah.
Tell them that
for me.
I want to bring this up. Let me just get this before I forget there, Neil. because we get heated on this. So we're talking about the... because we have two musical theater people. I mean, Anna, you're kind of a musical theater person, you know, and, you know, definitely Matt is. So the you know, the going up a half step at the end of the chorus to make it bigger, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, they always do that with New York, and it just like it's half step higher than slower and bigger, and mm-hmm. it just keeps on getting bigger. But people, the great unwashed, love that stuff. So is it pandering? Is it giving them what they want? At the end of the day, are they happier?
I don't know. That's sort of like to me, like, oh, maybe I should just play something really, really fast so people will be impressed because, you know, oh, your fingers can, you know, move that fast or things like that. I don't know. Giving people what they want, and people can tell when something is cheesy, though, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm the arbiter of taste right here to say, you know.
Well, do you find how many of us do this, and maybe this is your case too, do you find yourself writing for that ideal audience, the people that you would want to appreciate your music? Someone like you who would think, okay, this is my ideal audience. This is how I'm going to write because this is what I want to write.
So be it,
and just put it out there.
I write definitely how I want to write, you know. I guess working under the assumption that I'm not a bad songwriter, you know. Which I guess takes a certain amount of ego to go, you know, I'm going to write what I want to write because it's going to be good, you know. I don't tend to think about... like in the moment of writing the song, in that, I guess in production, like if, you know, in the recording process, that's really where mm-hmm. I might think about choices of like, well, what would people like to hear? What would be interesting for an audience to hear?
Right.
But just in the construction of a song in terms of, you know, things like a cheesy, you know, obvious key change like that at the end. I'm maybe not thinking, I don't know. I mean, if I put if I wanted to put a key change in at the end, I wouldn't necessarily edit myself and go, oh, it's too cheesy. I don't want to write anything for those people. I don't know. but I'm definitely writing for myself.
Yeah.
First. I wanted to ask you, Anna, about a little more 30,000 foot view conceptual wise, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. what struck me about this song is how succinct it is.
Mm.
Like it's got its details, it's got its complexities, but on the whole of it, it's quite simple, it's quite to the point.
Yep.
And the tendency, I would think, especially with trying to tackle a topic like this, is you could say a lot.
You could.
Right. And I just wonder about your process in terms of, did you, like, you said earlier that it just kind of happened fairly quickly, but was there, like, how much editing was there? Because the details are really carefully considered, like read on the radio, you're repeating a lyric mm-hmm. where you change the mode and everything. Like it's quite tasteful in that way. And
yeah.
I don't know, a little part of me thinks no way it just came together in, you know, an hour. But
well, I mean, when I wrote this song, so I don't like to write bridges. I don't know how you guys mm-hmm. feel about writing a bridge, but
bridges.
It's not, for me, it depends on the song for sure. Yeah. But for me, like, it's not the thing that automatically pops out in the first couple hours that I'm working on a song idea. It's almost always is something that I come back in and go, you know, I really ought to put a bridge in this song, you know? And this is one of those songs that I, you know, after the fact came back and was like, no, I'm going to keep it simple. I'm not going to add another, you know, chorus or put in a bridge or create some other verse or something like that, because I really felt like that it had to be said. I wanted to say something plainly mm-hmm. and keep it to the point and keep it simple and not try to, you know, like if you're talking about a topic and you're too much on the nose, I didn't want to write it in a way that was telling people what they were doing wrong. And telling people what we should do next. Yeah. And I wasn't trying to, and honestly, I don't even think I was trying to like offer a solution in in the scope of a song, because like I don't have a solution to this problem. The solution is for people to stop being maniacs and for our government to do something. But, you know, I'm not going to put that in a song because this is something where I felt so deeply just brokenhearted about the situation that we're in. And I wanted to touch people in a way that was saying, this affects all of us. This can happen to all of us. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of a simple thing to say. We don't have to describe the problem in depth because we all know the particulars of it.
And that actually makes for a far more effective even protest song, because if you're being, like you say, if you're being didactic and and telling people what to think, then it kind of, it puts a lot of distance between you and the listener. Whereas the way you've done it, it's a much softer blow, as it were. And it allows the listener to really see themselves in the song, you know?
Yeah, and that's really what I wanted to do. I wasn't trying to point fingers. I was trying to say, like, in a roundabout way, trying to get people to take responsibility and put themselves in the viewpoint of, you know, I think that first, well, really, both of the verses have a lot to do with, you know, the collective, right? You know, in a place just like, you know, every place. That's the whole thing. And then it's not saying I have a voice that I use when I need to tell lies, or I have a voice. It's like we, you know, when, you know. So yeah, trying to be universal with it and keep it to the point and keep it simple.
I'd like to push back a bit because you know, it's a very succinct song, but it's and I don't think a bridge would have worked in it because it's really not a simple song. I mean, it sounds, you know, with casual listening, it sounds very melodious and you know, it pulls you along, but actually, I mean, there's like some interesting chord changes. The melody isn't, you know, simple. It's not, you know, it almost sounds like an old traditional song, because sometimes old traditional songs can be very,
I was going to make the same point, Phil. There's something very nostalgic and, you know, like the old 19th century English or American but folk it songs.
Like, so I wouldn't say it's like it sounds like a simple song, but it's actually not a simple song in terms of melody construction. The chords are different, and I think that allows you to be, you know, so you basically have two verses and two choruses, which isn't that's very, very short.
That's it.
But it doesn't feel cut off, and it doesn't feel like someone just went, well, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like anything's lacking.
Yeah, because there's enough, you know, it's like having a little bit of food, but it's all very flavorful and there's lots going on, you know, like, I don't know if I'd want 10 minutes of this because it would be, you know.
I don't think that there's anything like to, you know, doubling choruses. There's nothing really to drive home, I don't think. I think that if you, just that statement of, you know, he was acting alone. I think that to leave it plain like that is makes the point, you know. I think that just saying it plainly like that makes the point that, like, well, obviously he wasn't acting alone, you know?
Right. Yeah. And we end on the unresolved dominant seventh as well. Yeah. Was this a conscious decision in terms of the issue is not resolved, so therefore the song will have a similar sort of tension to it? Am I reading too much into that?
Well, I think it's a yes and no sort of thing. I tend to not like to resolve. I have a few songs where I either on the final chord will make it, you know, if it's in a minor key, I'll make the one a major. And we'll resolve it or leave it on an unresolved chord. So I think that I was, in a way, I was falling back on just something that sounds cool to me for whatever reason to leave it on an unresolved chord. And I think actually when we were recording it, my guitarist, he was like, well, you know, no, we're not. And I've had some folks since then say to me, what, we need to, you know, let's resolve this. And I've always been like, no, that's just the way the song needs to be, because that's the feeling that it has to have. I don't know. It's sort of like
they're Philistines.
Tell them from me. Okay. But that, I think a lot of times when I don't want to resolve it properly in a song, it's because I just like the way it sounds. But I think in this case, liking the way it sounds was because it fit with the emotion,
the theme, and the
theme. Yeah. I mean, it's a little thing we like to refer to as prosody, when those two things kind of line up, when everything in the song, emotion, intent, music, the notes you choose, all lines up in that same way. And by all means, they can be at odds with each other, and that's a thing too.
And that's a thing too, if you want to create conflict, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that having that unresolved chord, to me, is that's the only way the song can be, you know. That's just how it has to be.
It's interesting. This is something I've been thinking about for a while. You know, part of my job, I have a marketing company. So part of what I do is have to, you know, figure out what the client's client is, and then you put yourself into their headspace and you try to perceive everything, the messaging as the client would. So I've been thinking.
This is where the semitone comes from.
Appreciation. So I was thinking about, listening to stuff the way an audience would listen, because, you know, my friends never wanted to go to bands with me because, you know, you're a musician. So you go to a band and and everyone there enjoying it, going, oh, the singer's off and the drummer's really sloppy. And it took me years to realize that people don't care about that. They're having a beer and they're having fun. That's all they care about. Mm-hmm. And if it's got a good beat, they think it's fantastic. Happy. Yeah.
Totally.
And I always love to do those kind of open-ending bits of the song, but for someone who's never heard the song before, for the audience, leaves this in this weird space because they don't know the song's over. Just kind of go. And it's weird. And I noticed, and I remember thinking about that, and you notice there's this kind of weird hesitation, and then people kind of clap. Whereas if you do it and everything ends immediately, people sort of, it's kind of like, it's an interesting thing about whether or not to give pander to the audience or guide them.
This song is a really uncomfortable song in the first place. And when I had the opportunity, which still seems surreal to me, I had an interview with Bob Boylan of NPR Music. And it was at a music conference that was here in Austin. And I actually didn't know that I was going to have this interview, on a stage in a room full of people. So I was sort of like, and he asked me, he was like, how do you work this song into a set? Like, where do you put it? So honestly, the fact that that you have an unresolved chord at the end and it leaves you with that sort of unsettled feeling, that's going to happen with this song, with the content anyways. And in Texas, there are some venues that I've played where I've like, should I play this song? Am I going to get like, you know, angry rednecks?
You just go to Stand By Your Man and Rawhide.
Well, I just have to go into Dolly Parton. I have to go into a Dolly Parton song. No, I don't.
Exactly.
I've gone into Dolly Parton.
You can always resolve by the resolution is the first chord of the next song, which is way happier.
This is one of those songs that like there is going to be, and even if I ended on the one, there's going to be an uncomfortable silence after the song, because people are like, should we clap about this heavy subject that is terrifying, you know, what do we do in this moment? So
it's really interesting how you say like you're not pointing fingers, but some people are going to take it that way. You know what I mean?
Some people are going to take it that way.
I happen to agree with you, but
you
know.
Yeah. And I hope that most of your listeners do too. Cause they, you know,
I'm sure they will.
Switch it off. But
in Canada, we think you're loony. So,
Yeah, it's true. It's like pointing fingers without pointing fingers. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the kind of that you don't want to say. You can't come out and say, "Hey, you guys." I mean, the song wouldn't be artful if you were hitting things on,
yeah,
on
sure.
the nose and things like that. So, I don't know. Maybe there are other songwriters that can write protest songs and say things a little more plainly and don't feel bad about, you know, just, you know, pointing the finger. But I think I was writing this more from a point of like emotion rather than, take action or setting out to like have some sort of, not manifesto, but you know what I mean?
Right.
Writing from the perspective of the emotion surrounding the issue. I think that's, and you know, someone I was talking about, or I was listening to someone talking about songwriting and they were talking about, how to write, how to tell a story without the specifics of the story and talking about the emotion of the moment instead of, you know, characters and storylines and things like that. And I think that I definitely tend to lean in the character development in writing, you know, lyrics and things like that. I like the storytelling aspect of songs, and I don't always come at it from like a emotional, you know, the more generalized emotional sort of thing. But this song is definitely from that.
Show don't tell sort of situation.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Bruce Springsteen writes a lot of protest songs that get misinterpreted. Interestingly, like, you know, "Born in the USA" is not about right. being that USA.
It's actually
is great.
About being born in France.
Yeah,
and it's in there. If you look at it with the right and tight enough fitting hat, you can see that it's actually about being born in France.
Yeah,
and on that note,
it's a pretty good place to be, though. And I think the approach is right.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, and how do people get more of your stuff?
They can head to my website, which is annalarsonmusic.com, and Anna is two A's, two N's, and Larson is S O N on the end of it. I don't know. It's
like Gary.
Yeah.
All right, because that's all the time we have today on Song Talk Radio. Don't forget, we want to hear from you, so send us your comments on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Song Talk Radio, or send us an email at feedback@songtalk.ca. If you're listening on the podcast stream, why not check out the YouTube channel for live performance videos and full episodes so you can see our beautiful faces. If you're on YouTube, you probably should have subscribed by now. Subscribe today to the Song Talk Radio podcast on your favorite podcast provider, and don't forget to sign up for the free newsletter at the site as well. You can find links to all the products, books, and web services we mentioned here on the show on the resources page. And wherever you are in the world, why don't you join us online via Zoom for the next Song Talk meetup. Free to join on meetup.com and free to attend the meetup. Stop by songtalk.ca for the link. And most of all, we'd like to thank you, the home listener. You can follow me at philemery.ca. And how about you, Neil? How do people get more of you?
neilmody.com.
And Matt, how do people get more of your big musical brain?
MatthewCReed.com for the musical brain. Avoid everywhere else for the other brain.
And one more time, Anna, from you.
AnnaLarsonMusic.com.
This is great. I hope you can come back on our show sometime because we've got so much more to talk about, I think.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks.
And listeners out there, please stop by the website at songtalk.ca to browse past shows and find out how you could be a guest. Stay safe, everyone, and keep on writing.
So long.
Good night,
so
everybody. Long.
A little bit long, but the show was getting really good. I didn't want to end it.
So here's a good. This is a guitar tune. It's right in E. So there we go.
Yeah.
Classic E.
I lost all the tracks for this song, by the way.
What's that?
I lost all the recordings for this song.
Oh.
Because I didn't name the file properly. Because it started off as I think I called it Thing.
Okay.
And, you know, 3 years later, I was cleaning stuff up, but I don't know why, because I have lots of space on the hard drive, but I do that sometimes. Never and then I opened it up because I wanted to kind of take it to the next level, and it's all gone.
Oh, man. Absolutely. You can always do it again, I guess.
Do it again.
Revisit.
Do it better.
Do it better with the new technology we have.
It'll be a hit. A hit will tell you.
Yeah.